soon resign. Lake was one of the aides whose telephones were secretly tapped, with the approval of both Kissinger and Haig. In 1973, when Lake learned of the tap, he phoned Kissinger to discuss the matter. Kissinger said he knew nothing about the tap, paused, and added, "in any detail." Kissinger's inability to manage either personal relationships or staff organization, he couldn't even recognize his own senior staff members on the street, Coleman Hicks once remarked, became an accepted fact of life in the White House basement. It was Haig who kept things running smoothly, walking a tightrope between the staff and Kissinger and between Kissinger and the Oval Office. Haig managed the paper flow. He worked longer hours than anyone else in the office. He insulated the staff from Kissinger's wrath. He knew the cable traffic perfectly. He was gregarious, personable, likable. He wore a dinner jacket as comfortably as an army uniform. He assiduously avoided the intellectual and ideological debates which scarred the NSC staff. He tolerated, with superhuman strength, the abuse that Kissinger heaped on him. "Only someone schooled in taking shit could put up with it," Hicks observed to his colleagues. In Haig's presence, Kissinger referred pointedly to military men as dumb, stupid animals to be used as pawns for foreign policy. Kissinger often took up a post outside the doorway to Haig's office and dressed him down in front of the secretaries for alleged acts of incompetence with which Haig was not even remotely involved. Once, when the Air Force was authorized to resume bombing of North Vietnam, the planes did not fly on certain days because of bad weather. Kissinger assailed Haig. He complained bitterly that the generals had been screaming for the limits to be taken off, but that now their pilots were afraid to go up in a little fog? The country needed generals who could win battles, Kissinger said, not good briefers like Haig. On another occasion, when Haig was leaving for a trip to Cambodia to meet with Premier Lam Nol, Kissinger escorted him to a staff car, where reporters and a retinue of aides waited. As Haig bent to get into the automobile, Kissinger stopped him and began polishing the single star on his shoulder. "Al, if you're a good boy, I'll get you another one," he said. Haig bore silently any resentment he felt. He had always been able to avoid friction with his superiors. In the Johnson administration, his tireless work and smooth, easy manner had impressed his influential bosses at the Pentagon, Joseph Califano and Army Secretary Cyrus Vance. Haig had come highly recommended to Kissinger, who had installed him in the White House basement as his military aide at the start of the Nixon administration. One of Haig's early assignments was to prepare the daily NSC intelligence report, which was based on vast amounts of information that flowed into the White House Situation Room. His access to virtually every piece of intelligence that reached the White House was unique, and he quickly acquired a superior knowledge of each NSC project and component. He handled the immense volume of paperwork adroitly, sometimes placing his own memos on top of the stacks that went to Kissinger. As he became more confident, he sometimes rewrote memos submitted to Kissinger by other members of the staff. On other occasions, he sent memos back to their authors with instructions that Kissinger wanted them done differently. No one knew for sure if the desired revisions reflected the preference of the president, Kissinger, or Haig. As Haig asserted his growing managerial role on the staff, others who saw themselves as the brightest stars in the Kissinger constellation of aides were eclipsed. Though some resented Haig, few questioned his authority. He had complete access to Kissinger, and Haig assured his colleagues that he was acting in their own interests. If it happened rarely that someone balked at having his memo rewritten, Haig would explain that he was merely tailoring it to suit the idiosyncrasies of its recipient. "It was better for all concerned," said Haig, "that he deal with those shits, Kissinger, Haldeman, Colson, and the rest. He claims no political ambitions." "I've got to get out of here," he would remind Kissinger's civilian aides, "back into the real army, away from this temporary duty that could only screw up his military career." Still, the key to Haig's ascent was Kissinger, because Haig was almost indispensable to him. He provided order, discipline, predictability. Without Haig, there would be chaos. Pure military decisions bored Kissinger. Haig handled them for him.
He served as the NSC liaison to the Pentagon brass and kept their feathers unruffled.
Al, I'd invite you to this meeting, but the Army doesn't have anything at stake here, Kissinger would half-joke.
Among Kissinger's principal aides, Haig alone stayed on after the Cambodian invasion, and in June 1970 he was formally appointed as Kissinger's deputy. Though Kissinger was wary of granting any aide too much power, he was convinced that he could control Haig. Haig was loyal, at least the most loyal of Kissinger's subordinates.
It is clear that I don't have anybody in my office that I can trust except Colonel Haig, Kissinger told a senior FBI official in 1969 as he reviewed the wiretapped conversations of several other aides.
Richard Nixon was also an admirer. If the president stopped by the NSC office and found Kissinger gone, he would sit talking with Haig. Sometimes Nixon called Haig to his office to discuss military questions, which Kissinger was unable to answer, or which he had bucked to his deputy. Nixon began to test Haig, making vague negative comments about Kissinger, expressing concern that Henry was off on his own or that he was not following policies and procedures they had agreed upon. He wanted Haig's opinion. Delicately, Haig managed to defend Kissinger, at the same time making it clear that his ultimate loyalty was to the president. Kissinger began to be obsessed about what Haig and Nixon said to each other when they were alone. Kissinger regarded himself as a conservative in foreign policy matters, but Haig, he observed, was a right-winger. And Kissinger was concerned that Haig might establish a private relationship with the president that would diminish his own influence over Nixon in foreign affairs. Gradually, Kissinger concluded that he had handed Haig too much power. Haig was devious, duplicitous, he sometimes said now. Kissinger worried that Haig spied on him for the Pentagon, and worse, for the president. Kissinger's insecurities concerning his deputy finally reached such a pitch that he called in one of his secretaries, Julie Pigneux, to ask her who was the most impressive person she had met on the job, who was the best member of the NSC staff, the most competent. He was relieved, visibly, when she named Winston Lord, a Kissinger favorite. When he was around Kissinger, Haig took great care not to flaunt his relationship with Nixon. He was determined to succeed with both men. To Kissinger and his aides, Haig sometimes referred to the president as an inherently weak man who lacked guts. He joked that Nixon and Bebe Rebozo had a homosexual relationship, imitating what he called the president's limp-wrist manner. And around the men he cultivated in the Pentagon and the White House, Haig implied that Kissinger was too often the barrier to definitive military action. He complained about Kissinger's temper tantrums, his dishonesty, his disorganization, his reluctance to offend the weak-livered eggheads he had associated with in academia. These men thought Haig trusted them, because he was willing to share such harsh judgments with them. As the negotiations to end the war in Vietnam progressed, relations between Kissinger and Haig almost disintegrated. Nixon sent Haig to Southeast Asia to make independent appraisals of the military situation. Haig was the president's line to the battlefield. Returning, Haig argued successfully that the American withdrawal of troops should be conducted at a pace slower than that recommended by Kissinger. Kissinger felt that he had been undermined. Nixon sent Haig to Paris to observe Kissinger's bargaining with the North Vietnamese, and Haig counseled the president to take a harder line than Kissinger was pursuing at the bargaining table. Kissinger reacted with alarm and fury. Neither military nor diplomatic realities justified Haig's position, Kissinger said. Their arguments grew heated and personal. Kissinger was certain that Haig's intervention was making a settlement more difficult, particularly the settlement the president himself wanted, one which could be announced before Election Day 1972. On October 26th, less than 2 weeks before the election, Kissinger was able to announce that peace is at hand and that terms for a settlement had been agreed upon. When the prospect of settlement collapsed after the election, he blamed Haig. Kissinger was nearly certain that Haig, during his travels to Southeast Asia, had persuaded Vietnamese President Tu to hold out for better terms than Kissinger had negotiated. In December 1972, while Kissinger was negotiating in Paris, Nixon was closeted at the White House with Haig and Charles Colson. The peace talks were deadlocked. Both men told him Kissinger was once more taking too soft a negotiating position. The options cabled back to Washington by Kissinger included resumption of bombing in the North. Haig urged the president to take decisive action to finally bring the North Vietnamese to their knees. Nixon weighed his choices and acted. Haig informed John Scali of the president's decision. "This man is going to stand tall and resume the bombing and put those B-52 mothers in there and show 'em we mean business." In January 1973, Haig became Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, after Nixon had promoted him over 240 higher-ranking officers. He was given his fourth star. 4 months later, the departure of Haldeman and Ehrlichman from the White House underlined the changing realities of the second Nixon administration. For Nixon, for Kissinger, for Haig. As the president's popularity, his power, and his grasp on his office declined, Kissinger's was rising. It was no longer he who needed Nixon, Kissinger told his aides. Now it was Nixon who needed him. Kissinger wanted to be Secretary of State. Nixon promised him he would have the appointment. Kissinger explained to his aides why he wanted the job. Adding the State Department to his domain would complete his control of the foreign policy bureaucracy. As both Secretary of State and National Security Advisor to the President, he could protect diplomacy from the corrosion of Watergate. It had not escaped Kissinger that Nixon might destroy American foreign policy by trying to use it as a means of his own survival. It might fall to Kissinger to protect that policy from a president who is growing increasingly irrational and unpredictable, he said. And his appointment would bring along with it another particularly pleasant prospect, the humiliation of Secretary of State William Rogers. Kissinger hated Rogers. He thought him stupid, inept, weak. Kissinger enjoyed demeaning Rogers, keeping information from him, hurting him. Haig often spoke of Kissinger's amusement at seeing Rogers excluded from the process of making important diplomatic decisions. In the late spring of 1973, Rogers did not want to relinquish the secretaryship, especially to Kissinger. As Nixon considered whether to appoint Kissinger or John Connally to state, Rogers' tenure was extended several times. The president preferred Connally and expressed distrust of Kissinger to Haig, among others. Kissinger used his leverage. He threatened to resign from the administration unless Rogers was banished and his own appointment as secretary announced. Nixon capitulated, though unhappily. He was unable to bring himself to tell Rogers personally. Their friendship went back to the Eisenhower administration. In 1952, Rogers had been one of the few Eisenhower men who had defended Nixon against charges of maintaining a secret slush fund during the election campaign. Nixon sent Haig to convey the message to Rogers and get his resignation. Rogers, his pride already sorely wounded, was deeply offended. "Tell the president to fuck himself," he said. He refused to either resign or be fired by Haig. If he was to be dismissed, he wanted the request for his resignation to come from the president personally. "I'm sorry," he told Haig. There was no other way. Haig was angry and dumbfounded. He could not imagine a cabinet officer, or anyone else for that matter, refusing an order from his commander-in-chief. Nixon stalled and fretted and looked for a way to avoid confronting Rogers. When, on July 16, 1973, Alexander Butterfield revealed the existence of Nixon's taping system, Kissinger was outraged. How did the president dare to tape their meetings without his knowledge? He professed incredulity. The irony could hardly be lost on his aides. Yet Kissinger persisted. From an historical point of view alone, the president's taping system was insane, he said. It was indiscriminate. "To tape 8 years of conversation would take 8 years to listen to." He was contemptuous. "To leave yourself to the mercy of historians like that is unbelievable irresponsibility, particularly since Nixon conducted meetings with such fantastic indirection." For weeks, Kissinger turned to his closest friends and aides for advice and gave free rein to his anger, raising questions about Nixon's mental stability. Perhaps he should refuse to accept the position of Secretary of State and get out of that man's administration once and for all, while he still had a chance to emerge with his reputation intact. It was the first time that those who were closest to Kissinger believed he was serious about quitting. But Rogers, having reconsidered, was by then ready to leave the administration. He was disgusted with what he regarded as Nixon's specious claim of executive privilege in withholding the tapes. In August, Kissinger was nominated as Secretary of State. The appointment was confirmed in the Senate in September. By late October, after Cox had been fired, Kissinger's anxieties about the president had become more acute.
"Sometimes I get worried," he said. "The president is like a madman."
Kissinger was deeply pessimistic. He had looked to the second Nixon administration as a once-in-a-century opportunity to build a new American foreign policy, to achieve new international structures based on unquestioned American strength, détente with the Soviets and China, a closer bond with Europe. It seemed no longer possible. Watergate was shattering the illusion of American strength, he said, and with it, American foreign policy. He decried the brutal puritanism of the age. Whatever Nixon's transgressions, those who were attacking the president, especially the press, had no idea of the damage they were inflicting on international order, he said. Congress now felt free to interfere in foreign policy. Foreign leaders, allies and enemies alike, seemed perplexed by the president's inability to deal decisively with his own troubles, to make Watergate go away. America's ability to make good its commitments was in serious doubt throughout the world. Indochina would be the first great Watergate casualty, Kissinger predicted bitterly. The Congress, the press, and the people would never permit the administration to demonstrate the resolve needed to save it. When Vietnam fell, American foreign policy would be reduced to a myth. What good is strength without the will to use it? Kissinger asked rhetorically. The specter of the United States as a pitiful, helpless giant aptly described the Watergate America of Richard Nixon, Kissinger believed. Kissinger adapted his negotiating strategies to fit his perceptions of the moment. In talks with the Russians, the Israelis, the Arabs, and others, he sometimes alluded to Nixon's precarious position at home and tried to turn it to the advantage of his own negotiating stance. The president's troubles had made Nixon more determined than ever to take a tough line with potential adversaries. Kissinger portrayed himself as more reasonable, more flexible. He could understand the other side's position and would lend a sympathetic ear. But Nixon, he would imply, was beyond control and should not be tested too severely. If the other side could yield just a little ground, he, Kissinger, might be able to go back and convince the president to take a softer line. The stratagem usually worked, Kissinger and his aides believed, but they doubted that it would do for long. Scowcroft and Eagleburger reinforced Kissinger's belief that world leaders were relying on him more than the president. It was Kissinger who was the symbol of American legitimacy and continuity, not Nixon. Kissinger relished such stature. Yet ultimately, he said, his position was not very much more stable than the president's. That realization served to heighten his ambivalence toward Nixon.
"That SOB has got to go,"
he exploded frequently in the early months of 1974.
"He's going to have to resign.
It's inevitable." Then, after reflection, he would tell his aides,
"No, he shouldn't do it."
Then the month-long Middle East negotiations and the release of the edited transcripts pushed Kissinger still further from the president. Nixon was so desperate to obtain a Golan Heights agreement for domestic political purposes, Kissinger maintained, that he was undermining Kissinger's strategy and endangering the whole Middle East peace initiative. During one impasse in the talks, Kissinger told the Syrian president that unless immediate progress was forthcoming, he would break off the negotiations.
"If this isn't settled by Monday, I'm going home."
It was a risky tactic. Kissinger's sense of timing told him it would work. In Key Biscayne, Ziegler told reporters that Kissinger was under orders from the president not to leave the Middle East until there was a settlement. Fortunately, news of Ziegler's statement did not reach Damascus until after President Assad had made the desired concession. the negotiations moved quickly toward a settlement. Kissinger was infuriated. Nixon, he said, was determined to foster the illusion that he was in charge of the negotiations to save his neck.
"I'm the one who knows the placement of every goddamn soldier on the Golan Heights, not him," he complained.
Chapter 15. From Washington, Nixon viewed the situation differently. The Middle East settlement was a result of his own work, he told his family.
Henry wanted to come home, and I kept him on the job.
The negotiation was successful because the leaders in the Middle East knew they could rely only on my word. It was essential that he visit the Middle East now to demonstrate that his personal commitment would prevent another outbreak of war there. At 1:02 p.m. on May 29th, Nixon came into the White House press room to announce, on live television and radio, that there was a settlement. He looked worn and haggard.
"It is obviously a major diplomatic achievement," the president said, "and Secretary Kissinger deserves enormous credit for the work that he has done along with members of his team. As far as the United States is concerned, we shall continue with our diplomatic initiatives, working with all governments in the area toward achieving the goal of a permanent settlement, a permanent peace."
That night, on the Sequoia, the president entertained 11 congressmen, most of them Southerners. The guests ate beef tenderloin and heard Nixon's elation at the Middle East ceasefire. He spoke about the settlement in terms of his administration's continuing foreign policy triumphs. He listed past achievements and speculated on those to come. Haig sat quietly at the table. Mississippi Congressman G.V. Sonny Montgomery, touted by the press as Nixon's favorite congressman, asked the president what help he needed on Watergate.
"If I thought I was guilty, I'd quit,"
the president responded. There were, he told his guests, some tapes containing national security material so sensitive that he would never give them up.
Never.
On the morning of the 31st, Friday, Nixon breakfasted with Haig, Scowcroft, and Kissinger. He greeted the secretary, who had just returned from the Middle East, with nervous laughter.
"Where have you been, Henry?"
Kissinger was not amused. That same morning, the justices of the Supreme Court were meeting to consider the special prosecutor's petition that they decide the tapes case without prior review by the Court of Appeals. St. Clair had filed his opposing brief the day before, urging the justices not to rush to judgment, because hearing the case this term could prejudice the House impeachment inquiry. Buzzard had checked the Supreme Court docket and was confident they would prevail. The calendar was full. The justices would have a ready excuse to sidestep the issue. But the White House underestimated the degree to which Nixon's conduct had offended the court. The president's appointees, Chief Justice Burger, Harry A. Blackmun, and Lewis F. Powell, Jr., had all expressed their disgust to varying degrees, to their clerks and to each other. Justice William H. Rehnquist, the fourth Nixon appointee, had disqualified himself from the case because he had served as an assistant attorney general under John Mitchell. Nixon appeared to be willing to flout the rule of law openly in the expectation that they would rescue him. They felt he had put them on the line, and they were wary. The conference began with the justices seemingly split in their positions. Potter Stewart, Powell, and Douglas favored taking the case. The Chief Justice, Blackmun, and Byron R. White were opposed. Thurgood Marshall and William J. Brennan, Jr. held back while the others debated. They were well aware that if they failed to expedite their hearing of the case, the impeachment proceedings would take place without the congressional committee having a chance to get the disputed tapes. Justice Stewart's presentation was strenuous. The court had a responsibility to resolve the issue as soon as possible, not sidestep it. The principle involved was fundamental. The opposition argued that the importance of the issue was so great that the case merited full judicial review and thus should first be heard in the Court of Appeals. Justice Marshall, whose position was never seriously doubted by the rest, and Justice Brennan, too, came down squarely on Stewart's side. St. Clair's brief, it seemed, was based on a fundamental misreading of the situation. He was arguing that, as a matter of law, the court was precluded from considering a case that might affect the outcome of impeachment. His argument was insulting, several of the justices felt. As a practical matter, he might have a point, but they doubted there was support in the law for his view. At 3 p.m., the court announced that it would take the case on an expedited basis, bypassing the Court of Appeals. The Chief Justice laid out a timetable for briefs and oral argument. A ruling was possible before August. Buzzard read the decision as a clear signal that the court intended to rule against the president on the merits. St. Clair disagreed. They would still win, he predicted. The president was meeting with his senior political counselors, Dean Birch, Ann L. Armstrong, Roy Ash, and Kenneth Cole, when the court's action was announced. He asked for ideas on the 1975 State of the Union message and the 1975 legislative program. "I want to know what cabinet officers feel, so I can make a determination what we get into and not," he said. St. Clair was back in district court on Monday morning, June 3rd, to oppose the attempts of Colson and Ehrlichman to get White House files that related to the Ellsberg burglary case. Judge Gerhard A. Gessel had had his fill of stalling. He had warned St. Clair in their last encounter that unless the president turned over the subpoenaed files, the case against Colson and Ehrlichman would have to be dismissed, and he would hold the president personally responsible for aborting the trial. "I don't give a damn," Nixon had responded to his lawyers. "It wasn't fair in the first place that a man like Ellsberg should be free and his former aides on trial," he said. The courtroom was packed with spectators and reporters. St. Clair was nervous, waiting to find out whether Gessel would make good his threat and hold the President of the United States in contempt. Colson walked over and whispered something, but St. Clair couldn't hear it above the clamor of the spectators. St. Clair had gotten his introduction to Watergate through Colson in 1973, when Colson had retained him briefly to represent him in his own troubles. Colson had later passed St. Clair's name on to the president with praise. Now, as St. Clair watched, Colson approached the bench. He was speaking very softly to the judge. Something was happening. The courtroom became quiet. "I plead guilty, Your Honor," Colson said. There were audible gasps, including St. Clair's. Collecting himself, St. Clair fished a dime from his pocket and handed it to his assistant, Jack McCahill. He wanted Deputy Press Secretary Jerry Warren to have at least a moment's warning. That afternoon, St. Clair took the young lawyers on his staff to the Oval Office. They were upset that they had never met their client, and finally the president had agreed to see them. They gathered around the edge of the deep blue oval carpet, judiciously considering its gold-stitched presidential seal. Someone noticed that the floor was covered with linoleum, a bad imitation of wood grain. The president tried to make small talk. The White House photographer took a group picture of the client and his lawyers. After 10 minutes, they were ushered out. Leon Jaworski was by now convinced that the president had erased most, if not all, of the missing 18.5 minutes of conversation on the June 20th tape. But he lacked proof. On June 6th, Steve Bull was recalled before the Watergate grand jury. Aside from Rosemary Woods, he was the only member of the president's personal staff known to have handled the tape. Bull could not seem to shake the public stigma of Watergate, though the special prosecutor's office had never regarded him as suspect. The 5-hour session was grueling. Jaworski's assistant in charge of the grand jury, Ben Veniste, did not even break for lunch. But Bull had no more details about the gap than when he had testified the previous fall. Benveniste turned to the president's most recent review of his tapes in May. Bull gave him a file containing his cueing notes. The tapes were listed on unnumbered pages in the order in which the president had listened. Now Benveniste had what he wanted, a list of the tapes the president considered most important. He now knew which tapes Nixon had studied immediately before rejecting the compromise offer to keep his status as an unindicted co-conspirator secret. That the president had been named by the grand jury was no longer a secret. There had been huge headlines in that morning's Los Angeles Times and the Washington Post. Times reporter Ron Ostrow had gotten the story from one of the lawyers for the men indicted in the cover-up. St. Clair's response neither confirmed nor denied the report. The evidence before the grand jury does not support and indeed contradicts such an allegation by the grand jury. Furthermore, the evidence before the grand jury on the Watergate matter relating to the president is before the House committee and, together with information furnished subsequently by the president to the House committee, proves the president's innocence.
Bull was not the only member of the president's staff to be subjected to rigorous interrogation that day. Henry Kissinger held a press conference. He was expecting a docile, even congratulatory reception. It was his first meeting with the reporters since he had returned triumphant from the Middle East. But the reporters were more interested in the administration's wiretapping than in shuttle diplomacy. During his confirmation hearings the previous fall, Kissinger had downplayed his role in wiretapping reporters and White House aides. Under oath, he had maintained that he had merely provided others with the names of his assistants who had had access to leaked information. He had sworn that he never recommended that anyone be tapped. Now, Kissinger was faced with new accusations. The House Judiciary Committee had prepared an unexpurgated transcript of a conversation between John Dean and the president, which undermined his claim. Discussing the origins of the wiretapping program, Nixon had said on February 28, 1973, "I know that he," Kissinger, "asked that it be done." The reporter's sharp questioning upset the secretary. Had he recommended that his aides be tapped?
"I did not make a direct recommendation,"
his lower lip jutted out defiantly.
Then what sort of recommendation had he made?
"This is a press conference and not a cross-examination," Kissinger snapped. "I have attempted to serve this government in an honorable manner for 5 1/2 years. I do not conduct my office as a conspiracy."
Had he retained counsel in preparation for a defense against a possible perjury indictment? Kissinger tried to control himself, working his hands furiously behind him. Even his closest aides had never seen him so angry.
"No," he answered.
Kissinger was seeing his worst fears about the corrosive effect of Watergate confirmed. For the next 2 days, he fumed at the affront to his honor, his integrity. On Saturday morning, he discussed the matter over breakfast with Senate Majority Leader Mike Mansfield. The viciousness of the press was making it exceedingly difficult for him to conduct foreign policy, he told the Montana Democrat. If suspicion continued to hang over him, it would become impossible for him to carry out his responsibilities. He might have to resign. Mansfield sought to reassure the secretary, telling him not to even think about the matter, not to be goaded. The next morning's New York Times contained more information about the taps that contradicted Kissinger's claim that he played virtually no role in the program of surveillance. Kissinger called Mansfield at home. He was so disturbed about the rash of stories that he might not accompany the president to the Middle East, he said. His presence might diffuse the focus of the trip. Again, Mansfield sought to calm him. "Don't you dare think that way. You go. You're needed. You can be extremely helpful. The country depends on you," the majority leader said.
Chapter 16. At the White House, the announcement of the president's journey to Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Israel, and Jordan had been made in 5 separate press releases to meet traditional Arab objections to appearing in the same piece of paper as Israel. Bill Henkel, chief of the advance crew, was in the Middle East, trying to cram several months' preparations into a week. The precautions for the trip had to be extraordinary. Secret Service and CIA intelligence indicated that terrorists might try to kill the president. From Nixon's vantage point, the Middle East looked better and better compared to Washington. All he needed now was a good send-off. That had been left in the hands of his friend Rabbi Korf. 1,400 people were gathered in the Regency Ballroom of the Shoreham Hotel on Sunday afternoon, June 9th, for a testimonial luncheon sponsored by the National Citizens Committee for Fairness to the Presidency. As they waited for the president to arrive, Republican Senator Carl T. Curtis of Nebraska told them, The Get Nixon crowd, including those who conduct a trial by press, are in for a big surprise. The audience cheered lustily. The ambassador to Italy, John Volpe, brought them to their feet. "You just look at this Nixon family," he said. "They are a close-knit family." Pins were presented to the Nixon daughters. Mrs. Nixon was honored as a defender of the American family. Tricia told the audience, "You will be in our hearts all the days of my father's presidency. 965 more days." At 3:05 p.m., the president arrived and was welcomed by thunderous applause. He proceeded carefully. He built his case for support of the presidency, not of himself.
"Tomorrow, as you know, Mrs. Nixon and I will start a very long journey of 15,000 miles in which we will visit 5 nations, 4 of which have never been visited by a president of the United States before.
The rally on the eve of that journey," he said, "would be long remembered, not only by the president, but by all future presidents for whom you are working." He listed past triumphs, ending the Vietnam War, opening relations with China, achieving détente with the Soviet Union. He turned to his even greater ambitions.
"I can assure you that the hope for building a peaceful world rests in the leadership of the United States, and that leadership, of course, rests in the hands of whoever may be president. I shall do nothing to weaken this office while I am holding this office."
He was interrupted by cheering. "God bless Nixon!" the crowd shouted.
"One final personal thought," the president said, and he quoted a letter written to a White House stenographer by her boss. "We have been together ever since we came to Washington in 1969 as part of this great adventure, on January 20th of that year, and we shall leave together only when we have completed our service, and we shall leave heads high on January 20th, 1977.
The crowd roared. Tricia and Edward Cox stood to his left, Rabbi Korf on the right. He lifted his right arm and formed the familiar victory sign. As he left the podium, he was limping slightly. The next morning, as Air Force One headed for Salzburg, Austria, Henry Kissinger was still brooding. He was with Eagleburger and Scowcroft in the spacious staff quarters just behind the president's private cabin. They could see how terribly worn Kissinger looked. Scowcroft thought Nixon's trip should have been postponed for 6 weeks or so to give Kissinger more time to recover from his exhausting month in the Mideast. The wiretapping accusations had frazzled him. But the president wanted to get out of the country to strike the pose of world peacemaker. Kissinger's problems would just have to wait. But the allegations were serious. The House Judiciary Committee now had copies of all the FBI's raw files about the taps. They contained memos that were bound to implicate Kissinger even further. Some quoted Haig as saying that Kissinger had requested certain taps personally, and that Kissinger had told the FBI that whoever leaked information to the press should be destroyed. Kissinger had visited Bureau headquarters to read transcripts of the tapped conversations. Aboard the plane, Kissinger told his aides that he saw an endless attack being mounted against him. Eagleburger and Scowcroft both recognized that Kissinger had shaded the truth in his testimony. They searched for a solution. Eagleburger had already proposed to Kissinger that he hold a press conference to denounce the stories and threaten to resign if necessary. Scowcroft had opposed it. There had been relatively few stories, he said. Threatening resignation would indicate that Kissinger was overly sensitive on the subject. It would suggest that he was covering up. But Kissinger was coming around to Eagleburger's view. He couldn't ignore the attack. Sooner or later, it would have to be answered. In the hands of the 38 members of the House Judiciary Committee, the FBI documents would be leaked in the most unfavorable light. Perhaps it was time to go on the offensive. "Henry, then do it," Eagleburger told him. Kissinger went forward to see Haig.
"I've had enough. It's got to be met head-on," he told the general. He did not mention that he might threaten resignation, only that he was considering a press conference.
Haig took the matter to the president. When he came back, he indicated that Nixon was concerned that a press conference might distract attention from the president's mission. Perhaps Kissinger should think it over.
Ziegler was even less pleased and suggested that Kissinger take the standard White House line of denial. I won't dignify it with comment. But when the plane landed in Austria, the party learned of another unfavorable story, as well as an editorial in the New York Times, and the State Department press office saw more coming. Boiling, Kissinger stayed up until nearly dawn, talking with Eagleburger and Scowcroft and with advisors back in Washington. His mind was made up. They all recognized that if the stories continued full tilt, he might have to make good on a threat. A public threat to resign could be made only once. Kissinger needed to break the continuing chain of accusation and denial. He needed a grace period from attacks in the press. Mansfield had told him that he would be called before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to answer the new charges. Kissinger decided to preempt the committee. He would demand publicly that it open an inquiry into the accusations against him. That would force the attackers to pause. Hearings could not take place until after the Middle East trip. Kissinger's staff would have time to assemble the memos and documents that could be used to answer each of the accusations and support the secretary's version of events. He would be in an extremely sympathetic forum with senators who supported him and his policies. He drafted a letter to the Foreign Relations Committee. At 5 a.m. Salzburg time, members of the press office staff began knocking on the doors of reporters' hotel rooms. There would be a press conference, first thing, before breakfast. Filing into a cavernous room in Cavalier House, most of them expected Kissinger to hold forth on his expectations for the presidential journey. He walked to the microphone. Last Thursday, a number of you commented on the fact that I seemed irritated, angered, flustered, discombobulated. All these words are correct, he said. He read his letter to the committee and expressed concern that he hadn't had an opportunity to respond fully to the accusations. The impression has been created that I was involved in some illegal or shady activity that I am trying to obscure with misleading testimony. He laid out the situation from his perspective. In 1969, he was conducting sensitive negotiations. Leakers were endangering those negotiations. Some of his aides were suspect because of their ties to the previous administration. He had been told that prior administrations had conducted wiretaps to protect the national security. Accordingly, he had provided information on who had access to data that had been leaked. He had known that they would probably be tapped, but the president, not he, had initiated the wiretapping program. Though he found it distasteful, he had accepted it. He appealed for understanding. All of you in this room know from your profession that the truth very often has intangible aspects. And he deplored the climate in which unnamed sources can attack the credibility and the honor of senior officials of the government without even being asked to identify themselves. His aides cringed at that reference. They were all aware that Kissinger's credibility had been called into question by FBI memos signed by Director J. Edgar Hoover himself, and by the president's own taped words, not by unnamed sources. Kissinger seemed on the verge of tears, and his voice choked as he talked about his place in history. When the record is written, one may remember that perhaps some lives were saved, and that perhaps some mothers can rest more at ease. But I leave that to history. What I will not leave to history is a discussion of my public honor. I have believed that I should do what I could do to heal division in this country. I believed that I should do what I could do to maintain the dignity of American values and to give Americans some pride in the conduct of their affairs. I can do this only if my honor is not at issue and if the public deserves to have confidence. If that cannot be maintained, I cannot perform the duties that I have exercised, and in that case I shall turn them over immediately to individuals less subject to public attack. The questions from the reporters indicated that they were skeptical. I want to make absolutely clear I am not making this as a threat in order to gain support, Kissinger responded. I'm stating an objective fact. It is impossible and incompatible with the dignity of the United States to have its senior official and to have its Secretary of State under this sort of attack in the face of the dangers we confront and the risks that may have to be run and the opportunities that may have to be seized. This is a fact
This is not a threat.
One reporter wondered aloud if the same standard might be better applied to the president.
The president is the only nationally elected official, Kissinger replied. For a president to resign under attack would raise the most profound issues of national policy, and in my judgment, a president can leave office only according to the constitutional processes that have been foreseen for it.
Finally, Kissinger, Haig, and Ziegler strode in step from the room, their bearing grim and military. Minutes later, Ziegler stormed into his staff quarters. He hadn't wanted Kissinger to have a press conference, let alone threaten to resign. It was an inauspicious start for the president's trip. God damn it, he shouted. Again, the focus was on Kissinger, not the president. Once more, the attention was on administration scandal. How the hell could they divert attention from Watergate with Kissinger dragging it across the sea? Haig reported back to Kissinger on Nixon's reaction.
Good job, and the president won't accept your resignation, he said.
Haig was disturbed, however. This business was hurting his own credibility. He was the Kissinger deputy who had implemented each of the taps through the FBI. Kissinger's denials were bound to focus further attention on his own role. Clearly, he would be the key witness before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The central question would be who had initiated the taps, the president, Kissinger, or Haig? Watergate was engulfing the president, and now it was threatening Kissinger and himself. That evening, Kissinger dined with Scowcroft, Eagleburger, and Peter Rodman, his personal aide. The press conference had been cathartic. He replayed it between bites of Wiener Schnitzel. Was it the right thing to do? Had he said the right things? What would the reaction be? What would the Russians think? The reassurance of his aides helped. For the first time in his career, Kissinger had taken the sort of public gamble that had succeeded over the years for Richard Nixon. He sensed that it was Nixon's almost demonic courage that had made the president what he had become. Nixon was often as careless with power as a tightrope walker who downed three drinks before walking across the canyon, Kissinger thought. That was the quality of Nixon's leadership that he both admired and feared. Now he had adopted the same precarious stance himself. While most members of the presidential party concerned themselves with Richard Nixon's political life, Major General Walter Tatch, his personal physician, was worried about the president's life, period. During Nixon's years as vice president and president, Tatch had examined his principal patient regularly. Nixon was a healthy man, generally, not given to complaining about minor discomforts. Tatch relied on those around the president, particularly his valet, Manolo Sanchez, for information. It was unusual for the president to summon him on the spur of the moment, as he did this day. Tatch hurried to Nixon's sitting room. The president greeted him perfunctorily and pulled up his left pant leg. Tatch could see that the leg was inflamed and swollen. He examined the leg more closely, then went through a series of checks which confirmed his fears. A blood clot had formed in a vein in the leg, he explained. Phlebitis. The clot could break loose and go to his heart or lungs. That could be fatal. Continuing the trip was a senseless risk, Tatch told him. Strain from extended standing, climbing stairs, long walks, even crossing his legs might free the clot. He recommended that the president be hospitalized immediately and, after enough rest to ensure that the clot had stabilized, that he fly back to Washington for further treatment. The president rejected the advice.
The purpose of this trip is more important than my life. I know it is a calculated risk.
He was obligated to finish what he had started. Tatch gave him a support hose. Nixon tried it on. It was too uncomfortable, he said. The physician told him the only good news he could think of. His diet, at least, was proper for the illness. Leaving his patient, Tatch hurried to Haig's room. He shook as he told him the diagnosis. I am going to order him to go home, Tatch said, and he bolted for the conference room, where Bull and Henkel had established a temporary office. It was ornately decorated, with pictures of Hitler hanging on the walls. The Führer had used the room during the war, carving up Europe on a map. Tatch did not pause for pleasantries.
Does the president have a lot of standing to do? Will he have to go on any long walks? Will he encounter a lot of stairs? The schedule called for Nixon to be on his feet extensively. The next day's schedule, Cairo, Henkel said, was particularly rough. There was a lot of standing, walking, climbing. Is there any way we can change this? Tosh sounded scared. No. It's too late, said Henkel. They paced back and forth to avoid being overheard by others in the room. Tosh said that Nixon belonged in a hospital. He should never have made the trip. The president has a death wish, he said. He won't take my advice. He won't listen to me. He explained how death could be instantaneous if the clot broke free. Usually, Henkel and Bull made light of Tosh's concern about the president's health. He was easily alarmed. They preferred to take the advice of Nixon's other physician, Lieutenant Commander William Lukacs. One White House joke held that Tosh carried two cures in his medical bag, a bottle of aspirin and Bill Lukacs's phone number. But the president, meanwhile, had quietly summoned Lukacs. It was the first time both doctors had accompanied him on a trip. Though he was sensitive to the danger of offending his senior physician, Nixon had more confidence in the younger man. Lukacs seemed more precise and more sure of himself. His diagnosis was the same, and his warning equally dire. He too tried to convince the president to terminate the trip. Nixon was just as adamant with him. He issued his own order. No one was to mention his condition. It had to be kept absolutely secret. Its disclosure would further harm the objectives of his presidency. In Washington that evening, Whitehead and Buchan met with the new members of the transition team for the first time. Brian Lamb, Whitehead's assistant at the Office of Telecommunications Policy, Larry Lynn, a former aide to Kissinger at the NSC, Jonathan Moore, formerly an assistant to Rockefeller and then to Elliot Richardson. The five men sat around Whitehead's dining room table drinking Cokes. Buchan stated the problem. Some groundwork had to be done for Ford in the event that he had to take over the presidency on short notice. Ford himself would have nothing to do with such preparation. Accordingly, Buchan was acting on his own. Ford was not aware of the existence of the group. Buchan spoke of Ford as an old friend, decent and honest, but very limited in his knowledge of the presidency. Ford would literally need a notebook, Buchan said, one with tabs that would specify in simple steps each decision and action required of a new president. There was another problem. If Ford became president, he would be besieged by old political friends, each of them with ideas and advice on how to proceed. Ford had always been susceptible to such pressure, Buchan said. Former Secretary of Defense Laird's name was mentioned. Articulate, charming, and intelligent, all agreed. But he was also an incorrigible schemer who would approach the new president, if it ever came to that, with grandiose plans. They were certain. The transition group should find a way to shield Ford from his influence. Haig was still another obstacle. Already Ford had come to like and trust the Nixon chief of staff. Lynn and Moore in particular were concerned about this. Haig could not be trusted, Lynn said. The general's capacity to beguile and his position in the Nixon White House could pose dangers for Ford. Haig was the chameleon bureaucrat. Moore elaborated. The general was tired. He would quite naturally be preoccupied with justifying past behavior and associations. Men like Haig would never be able to give their total allegiance to the new president. The group decided that each member would write short papers on their areas of expertise, economics, National Security Council, the departments, etc. They estimated they had until early September to complete their work. There was one last item on the agenda, Nixon's legal future. They agreed that Ford needed to be protected from entreaties that Nixon receive preferential legal treatment upon leaving office. The outgoing president should be accorded respect, not harassment or vengeance. But the potential that someone might approach Ford for a deal was dangerous. The new president would have to be warned that such an attempt should be rebuffed. Whitehead walked Buchan out to his car to talk privately. What would happen if Nixon were impeached and convicted and then refused to leave office?
Maybe the notion of the president resisting removal was not so absurd. Suppose he went crazy and tried to use the military to retain office. The two men wondered if perhaps they should raise the question with the Secretary of Defense, James Schlesinger. What if it became necessary to remove the president through the 25th Amendment's provision relating to incapacity to govern?
Under the 25th Amendment, the vice president and a majority of the cabinet can declare that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, whereupon the vice president would become president. However, if the president maintains that no inability exists, both houses of Congress decide the issue. A vote of 2/3 of the members of each house would be required to remove the president. They decided they were obliged to consider every possibility, no matter how remote, how unthinkable. On the morning of June 12th, the president and his entourage made the 3-hour and 45-minute flight from Salzburg to Cairo. Their motorcade entrance into the capital was jubilant. Several hundred thousand people lined the curbs, rooftops, and balconies. For 3/4 of an hour, Nixon stood in an open limousine with Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. Cheering workers, soldiers, schoolchildren, trucked to their stations by the thousands, waved placards which hailed the president as a man of honor and proclaimed both leaders great statesmen dedicated to peace and progress. Sadat was the perfect host. His welcoming remarks seemed to grasp Nixon's purpose. The role of the United States under the leadership of President Nixon is vital to promote peace and tranquility in the area. It is a great challenge, but I am convinced that with goodwill and determination, statesmen of the stature of President Nixon are apt to meet it. Nixon thanks Sadat privately for the huge crowds.
"Wait until we get to Alexandria," Sadat said.
Henkel, in charge of advance, had vigorously opposed making a stop there. Having the presidential party overnight in Alexandria meant additional security arrangements and hosting a formal banquet without benefit of a resident embassy. The American ambassador was also opposed. He was offended at Nixon's preference for public appearances over substantive meetings. But the president overruled them both. The trip to Alexandria, by train, was politically important to Sadat, he said. As promised, the crowds were spectacular, even before they reached the port city. Every mile of the route was lined with peasants, soldiers, workers, women crowded close to the passing train, expressing their approval in the Arab high-pitched warble of prayer. A magnificent white stallion, mounted by a soldier carrying the flags of both countries, raced beside the tracks. The horse reared and threw its rider, then kept the pace alone. Ziegler estimated that 2 million people had turned out. The president's party rode in a luxurious rail coach that had been built in the 19th century. Many drank strong, dark beer from quart bottles. Dr. Lukash read the bestseller, Jaws. A Secret Service agent interrupted him.
"You are wanted up front."
Lukash was horrified when he reached the president. Nixon, in total disregard of his physician's advice, was standing in the open-sided Victorian observation car, waving to the crowd. The president and Sadat shifted places from one side of the open car to the other, acknowledging the cheers, each holding on to the overhead brass railing to keep his balance. Lukash could see that the president was doing his best to disguise great pain. The physician took a seat on the red leather banquette in the rear of the car. The full-length green curtains dividing the coach kept him out of sight of the camera crews up front. He reached into his medical bag. A few minutes later, Nixon limped into a private compartment in the front of the train, where Lukash joined him. The physician gave him a painkiller and pleaded with him to keep off his feet. Nixon went back to stand with Sadat. Secret Service agents scanned the crowds, almost desperately. Reports were coming through of a terrorist raid on an Israeli kibbutz, in which 3 women had been killed. In Beirut, a Palestinian terrorist group was taking credit for the attack.
"That is how every Arab should receive Nixon, the chief imperialist in the world," its communiqué said.
Despite the massive presence of heavily armed Egyptian security forces, the president's exposure to the huge crowds seemed a senseless risk to his Secret Service contingent.
Dr. Tosh sought out Dick Kaiser, head of the Presidential Protection Unit of the Secret Service, and expressed his alarm at Nixon's behavior.
"You can't protect a president who wants to kill himself," Kaiser responded.
Shortly before reaching Alexandria, Nixon and Sadat spoke informally with several of the 126 reporters aboard the train. Nixon moved again to the open side of the railroad car, calling their attention to the size and enthusiasm of the crowds. Sadat pointed to one of the many banners. "We trust Nixon.
He has fulfilled every word he gave," Sadat said.
Encouraged by the White House advance office, Egyptian officials in Alexandria had mobilized a campaign-style greeting. By the time the presidential party arrived, more than 1 million people stood on the seawalls and in the streets. Some had climbed lampposts. The official party traveled by motorcade to the Ras El Tin Palace, where the president hosted a banquet for Sadat. It was as luxurious a residence as Nixon had ever seen, magnificently opulent. It had taken King Farouk 30 years to build. As he toasted Sadat, the president again remarked on the crowds.
"There is an old saying that you can turn people out, but you can't turn them on,"